and who are doing fundamentally the same thing. So you can go home and take a look. And so I'm giving them resources. Sometimes I'm giving them a sales letter copy out of my file, that sort of thing.
Right.
It doesn't detract from their desire, you know, to have it done for them at all. It simply builds it. So now I'm doing prescription. And by the end of the day, we've laid out a pretty detailed plan, a prescription of this needs to be done, 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 this needs to be done. And I am waiting and for them to say, can you do it? Will you do it? If you can do it, when can you fit it in? And how much is all this going to cost me?
Right.
And then I'm figuring up the project. Now, they have paid for this day. So from the very beginning, the positioning is they have bought and paid for advice. They have not come to me with an assignment. And I'm not a vendor salesman pitching them. They have paid and they have come to me for advice. And I've spent three and a half, four hours probing them and listening to them and having them talk to me about their business and mentally now cataloging all of the things that ought to be done. And so that's my client intake procedure. And that's my client process. Now, the other thing that has changed, of course, is I used to be willing to travel to them to do this. I no longer am. They almost come to me. But I used to go to them. And so they pay the fee plus first-class airfare round trip. And I used to, I only stopped 2 years ago, I used to give them full credit for the day to the project fee that came out the back end of the day.
Right.
So it made the day feel like it was free. I no longer do that. But I used to.
Because you don't have to.
Yeah. Yeah, but I used to.
Okay.
And I probably could have stopped sooner than I did, by the way. I'm guilty like everybody else. So
that's price. Nice to hear.
So that's the takeaway selling process.
Wow.
Is it starts from square one.
Okay. Wow. Wow. I'm just blown away. That's amazing. Well, we're moving toward the last quarter of our time, so... Shall I jump into some of the other questions?
Sure.
Okay, all right, let's do that. Our friend Raja has a question about what to do with a prospective client who says he can't pay what you ask, but he wants to do the project for less because he's going to give you more work down the line.
There's nothing about that that can't be cured with a bullet. I mean, you know, I mentioned earlier about the client who immediately begins to try and negotiate.
And
you know, this is not negotiation any more than you negotiate with a heart surgeon. This is, here's the project fee, here's the royalty, here's how I work. This is a take it or leave it proposition. Now, you may put two or three possibilities on the table for a client.
Right.
But you got to control the options, and they pick one. You can't be negotiating with them.
Right.
And the world is full of clients who want to play, you remember the character in the Popeye cartoon?
Right.
Wimpy, right? Please give me two cheeseburgers today and I'll pay you next Wednesday. Okay? The world is full of those clients. You make me rich and then I'll pay you. That's a very good way for you to stay poor. Okay? And if you let bad business take up your desk space, there's no room for good business. Now, most of these kinds of questions, though, arise because the process that you started with your client, all the way back from the who you selected, how you attracted them to you, how you dealt with them from the beginning, and how you were positioned with them, you screwed that up to allow these kinds of questions.
So it all interconnects.
Yeah. Most of this goes away when you are properly positioned from the beginning.
Makes sense. That makes sense. Well, Raja, for people on the call, was the other copywriter who had lunch with Dan, and it was not a free lunch. I bought. I had to wrestle the credit card away from Raj, but he wrote you a testimonial from that lunch and said he made $16,000 off a letter just from some advice that you gave us in that hour. So,
well, we're glad he made money.
He made some money. He did. Now, Liz, I want to throw a few rapid-fire questions at you, and then open it up for a call for other questions.
If we have time.
Okay, yeah, that sounds great. All right, so there are a lot of questions like Reeves, how do you handle clients who want to change what you've already written? Or Kathy Goodwin says, how do you work with a client who wants short copy with dancing graphics? And someone else asked about the client who comes back with criticism of the copy from his wife. So,
yeah. If we had time, I have a very funny story about that, but we don't have time. But sometime for you, I got a very funny story about the wife problem. Look, first of all, again, a lot of this has to do with how you were positioned to start with, whether you're being a writer given a job,
okay,
or whether you're a guru who's in control of the process and prescribing and telling them what needs to be done. Another part of this has to do with who you get as a client in the first place. And so a lot of these problems come from having really, really, really dumb clients who don't, you know, they're trying to figure out direct marketing 101. What is an envelope? Why a live stamp? You know, and so you're going to have these arguments over every little damn thing.
Right.
And the best way to eliminate them is to have a smarter client. At the very least, you've got to bring your client up to speed. I mean, for example, I won't work with anybody who hasn't at least gone through my magnetic marketing system and read the ultimate sales letter book.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's like ground zero. So at least we're speaking the same language. And so it has to do with the client itself and who you got. It has to do with how strong you were at the intake. And by the way, I always prep clients for all of this. You know, I've got a little talk that I give them about the fact that you aren't your customer, and your likes and dislikes are irrelevant, just as are mine, just as are your mother-in-law's, your employees. The only vote that counts is the people who give you money.
You should put that on a DVD, Dan.
And so I have this little talk with them.
Okay.
Early, that they aren't necessarily going to like what they get, and that everybody around them is going to be making fun of them and criticizing it. But they've got to prize results more than they prize anything else.
Right.
It also has to do with your contract language and exactly how your relationship works. So, for example, changes. Here's how it works with me. I'll make one round of changes that have to do with factual inaccuracies,
right,
legal issues, that are true legal issues, not a lawyer trying to be a copywriter, but a lawyer being a lawyer, and anything I consider to be legitimate input from the client. However, I'm the writer, you aren't. And so I'll make one round of changes, and then I deliver it in its best form that I believe is going to be most effective. If you insist on butchering it after that, I don't get my hands bloody. So you can do all the damage you want if you insist on it, but I'm not doing the damage. You will kill yourself with your own sword.
That makes sense. There's a few more questions that were sent in that kind of represented the group, if I could just throw those out.
Yep.
All right. Michelle Teresa Wasik asked how you can grow your copywriting business in a recession.
Well, A, I can't imagine why the question is asked. And I hope to God it is not a reflection of the fact that she thinks we are in a recession. I cannot recall as good of an economy in my lifetime. And money is flowing elbow deep in the streets, and anybody who tells you otherwise is either an imbecile or an incompetent. However, I did start my business during the Jimmy Carter recession.
Uh-huh.
And the fact of the matter is, it doesn't make any damn difference whatsoever.
Okay.
The pros and cons are different, but in a recession, there's automatic economic pressure on the winners and those who are going to survive to work harder and to market harder, and they need you more urgently. They may have a tougher time paying you, but they need you more urgently. So you still have a great card to play.
Good news. Okay, Kathy Goodwin wants to know if she should publish her rate.
Well, it depends on what you mean by rate.
Uh-huh.
I do not believe in things like dollars per hour, dollars per page, a fixed price for a direct mail campaign stuck up on a website or a price list. What I have always published are the consulting fees, the price for the day and the price for the hour if it's telephone consultation. I've always published those so everybody knows they're getting the same deal. The other stuff has to vary by project. And there's no way to give a fee until I've done diagnosis and prescription. And I'm basically calculating the project fee based on the amount of time it's going to take. And it may take me a lot longer to write a five-step direct mail campaign for Charlie than for Harry, in part because of Charlie and because they're in two different businesses and depending on the raw material they're bringing to the table. So those fees I would never publish.
Right. Got it. All right. Now, how long did it take you to establish yourself as a leader in the copywriting profession?
I forget who that was.
That's from Yancey.
Well, that's a flattering question. I'm maybe less visible than some people, but I'm certainly maybe the highest priced.
I agree.
But here's what's a more relevant answer. Is it's not that big of an advantage. It really is about creating demand for yourself, not creating prominence. And so, for example, I don't have any DMA awards on my shelf and could care less. And have never bothered with any of that stuff. It is about creating demand for yourself and making supply and demand work in your favor. And I began representing myself as the expert, the go-to guy for the clientele I sought from day one. And I have changed very little about the way I handle all of that from day one to now. And so you can't think of this as some kind of logical, sequential process, like you go to school for 4 years, and then some authority figure bestows upon you a degree, and you get to put some letters after your name, and then you serve an apprenticeship, and then you get to grovel, and then you get to claim a certain greater amount of credibility, and somehow there's a logical progression of fees and compensation and demand that matches your ascension up this career ladder. That's not how this works.
Yeah.
This works through self-aggrandizement and self-promotion. And as Ringer says in his book, you want a leapfrog. You don't want a ladder climb.
I like it. Okay, Nikki wants to know how a creative writer who wants to get into copywriting can develop a salesmanship mentality.
Well, the good news about her question is she asked the question.
Okay.
The bad news probably is the answer, but the good news is the question, because direct response copywriting is selling, and the copywriting business is sales, and so you do need a sales mentality. And the only way I know to get a sales mentality is through selling. And the truth of the matter, the best piece of advice you could ever give to somebody who freely acknowledged they don't have it,
right,
but are otherwise a competent writer, is to take a year off, don't write anything, and go work for 3 months selling fire alarms in the house, 3 months selling vacuum cleaners in the house, 3 months at a car dealership selling cars, and 3 months selling life insurance. And if it takes you longer than 3 months to get good at it, then stay there until you get good. And if you do that, you'll come out the other end of that funnel totally qualified, capable, competent, and able to write great direct response copy. Since most people will ignore that advice entirely, the next best thing is you have to be a serious student of salesmanship. And so you got to dig into stuff like Zig's Secrets of Closing the Sale, the book The Closers. You got to get sales training. As if you at least were going to go sell vacuum cleaners, fire alarms, automobiles, and insurance.
Got it. So Tamara says, I get direct marketing materials I find insulting. They don't work on me. Do they work enough to be successful? I never write such crud myself.
I've had my stuff called worse. Look, it comes back to the same speech I give clients. You aren't your customer.
Right.
Your likes and dislikes and personal opinions and preferences as are mine and as are the client's. The only thing that matters here is what works and what works best. And you got to get out of your own way. And direct response is not a place to be subtle. This is far more akin to the sale of the vacuum cleaner on the floor, wrestling the money out of the guy's wallet, than it is advertising or creativity. And to pretend otherwise, as pleasurable as it might be to pretend, is foolish. And so you've got to get over any little biases you have about long copy and analogies and ugly goldenrod paper and sneak-up gimmickry and goofy grabbers, and all of that stuff is what works in direct response. And so, yeah, does it work enough to be used? Yeah, it's what works. And it's pretty much what works regardless of whether you're selling to people who make $1 million a year or $10,000 a year, whether you're selling to them in their home or in the corporate boardroom. There's very little difference. There's very little difference between online and offline, and you got to get out of your own way.
And that's why it's used, because it works.
Absolutely.
Right? Well, I'd like to open it up for questions because we do have some time left. Yay. But I do want to thank you for letting us have access to some of your products at a discount, and remind people to go to red-hot-copy.com/dan.htm before 3 p.m. tomorrow. And that's Pacific time, so you get a few extra hours there. But there's some great alternatives to getting more access to Dan. So I encourage anyone to take him up on that. And why don't we open it up for questions? What we'll do real quickly is just say your name and if you have a question. And we were very polite last time, so let's see if we can do that again. All right, are you guys there?
Yeah.
Yay, there we are. All right, so does anyone have a question for Dan?
Yes,
Carol?
Diane.
Diane, go ahead.
And I just want to, you know, get back to what you said about from the beginning you charge clients for your advice.
Yeah.
When you're just starting out.
Doesn't matter. I did it from.
I know you did. How do you do it? How did you do it?
I did it from day one. It's here's how we do things around here. You know, think about when you go to the doctor's office. And you go to a dentist, or you go to a chiropractor, or you go to an eye doctor. Even when you take your dog to a veterinarian, okay, you walk in, the first thing they do is they hand you a clipboard and a form to fill out. And they tell you to go sit in the corner and fill out this form. And you go sit in the corner and you fill out the form. And they tell you how you got to pay. And you pay. And so they tell you, here's how we do things around here. And you do them. And I suppose every once in a while somebody walks out. I don't know. But that's how it works. And so you're a professional just like them. And people actually want to deal with a firm, strong person, not a weak person. And you are a trusted and expert advisor. And there's no reason for any reasonable, sane person to expect your time or advice to be free. And so you can't even assume the expectation. Most of them will never have hired one of what you are and how you position yourself, so it's not like they know how things are supposed to be done around here until you tell them how things are done around here. So when somebody now asks the question, can you help me, or can you create marketing for me, or can you write copy for me, or can you solve my marketing problems, the answer is quite possibly, and here's how I work. And then I say, everything starts with an initial consultation, and the fee for the initial consultation is X, and what I used to say is, and the fee for the initial consultation is fully credited towards the project fees if, in fact, we wind up going ahead with a project. The rest of that little speech is for the day, and so we get together for a day, and it's diagnostic and prescriptive, and I go through all that, and then at the end of the day, one of three things happens. I don't say this anymore, but I said it for many years. At the end of the day, one of three things happens. One is you consider the day to have been a giant waste of time and you didn't get any value out of the day, and all you have to do is tell me and I hand you your check back. And we part company and we hug and we're still friends. Two, you got what you needed out of the day. You got a great battle plan. You got answers to your problems and you're going to go ye forth and do things. on your own, and I will applaud as you succeed happily. And if you need additional time from me, you can buy it hour by hour on the phone. Three, you and I are going to agree on some project work that I should do for you to implement marketing and to write copy and to make the plan happen. And if we do, we're going to agree on a project, and we're going to agree on my fees for that project. And the good news is the fee you paid for the day will be fully credited to the product fee. When I used to do hour appointments, same basic speech. You're buying an hour, we're a diagnostic, prescriptive, at the end of the hour, ba-da-ba-da-ba-da.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. Is that helpful?
Yes, very. Thank you.
All right. Who else has a question for Dan?
Carol.
Who is this?
Carol? Yes.
Hi, Carol. Go ahead.
Hi. Dan, I noticed in that last answer that you said that if a person wasn't happy with their day's consultancy, you gave them their money back.
Yeah.
Which effectively is the risk reversal guarantee.
Right.
Do you do any sort of risk reversal guarantee with your projects these days, or did you do in the beginning?
No. Never did, never do. Once they're past the day, they've had enough exposure to me to either know that they want my work or they don't. And
right.
There's too many ways the client can screw it up.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever that question is raised, I'm very blunt about that. I say, unfortunately, this depends as much on what you do as it does on what I do, and I can't control what you do.
Mm-hmm.
There, I used to have a big sign in my office that I got from Halbert of the 82 ways copywriters can fail to get paid, and you know, the first 81 of them, our client screws it up. And so, no, I never did, never have, never would. The question does come up. You're absolutely right,
mm-hmm.
you know. The question will come up, well, how do I know I'm going to get results? And very frankly, I don't know if you are either. You know,
mm-hmm.
Based on my experience, we're going to give it our best shot here, and we have our suppositions about what we think should happen. And as long as you're testing, I'm going to keep tweaking to make it work, but there ain't no guarantees.
Okay. Thank you, Don.
You're welcome.
Hey, Dan.
Hey.
Harlan Gilstein here. How you doing?
I'm great, sir. How are you?
Harlan.
Okay. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
Dan, when you're evaluating a client and sizing up in your mind, especially if you go back a bunch of years and not look at things as you see them today, how would you evaluate a client in terms of going for a piece of the action? How do you add things up in your head?
Well, I very rarely did those equity deals.
I'm talking about royalty.
Oh.
Versus a flat fee.
Oh, well, it was never versus for me. From the very beginning that I discovered royalties in the 70s, it's always been fee plus a royalty, just as it is today. So, again, the dollar amounts have changed, but the formula has not changed.
What's the formula?
The formula is a project fee plus a royalty. And I am calculating the fee based on how many days I believe it'll take me to do the project if I locked myself in a room and did nothing but that project nonstop. That's not, of course, the way I do the work. But so I'm figuring out what the project's going to be, and okay, is this going to take me eight, if I did nothing but this, is it 8 days? If it's 8 days, it's eight times what my minimum day's fee is, and that's the project fee. Then the royalty is between 3% and 7% depending upon the product category. And so, like in hard product where they have low margins and high manufactured costs, you know, I may be at 3%. In soft product, like say seminars or information products where they have enormous margin, I may be at 7%. And so there's that little sliding scale of where I set the royalty. And that's always been arbitrary within that range. So the formula hasn't changed, like, ever. Just the dollar amounts have changed. I always assume that the royalties are my get-rich money. The fees are my wage money. And I always assume there will be no royalty. That's a happy thing when it happens. Because, again, there's too many ways the client can screw it up.
Oh, yeah.
So I won't do I've got to be happy with the fee for the project to do the project. Then I'm hoping for the royalties to grossly exceed the fee, and to stretch out over a long period of time. And sort of a secondary issue, again, is I'm trying not to, and I always did, try not to get myself saddled with a client who I really believe is so dysfunctional they can't implement at all. And every once in a while you miss. Frankly, my misses have been more with major corporations than they have been with entrepreneurs. But so it's always fee plus. It's never royalty instead of fee. There are copywriters who do that, by the way. And in fact, guys who do beat the control, of course, put it all on the back end. And so they only start getting paid if theirs becomes the new control. I don't do it, haven't done it, but there's guys who do it and do a lot of it.
Yeah.
Okay?
So you never go, you only do on money and you never do on like mailing pieces.
Oh, well, like use fees? Where they pay by the piece for each piece they mail?
Yeah.
Yeah, I try and stay out of those games. We went over those different compensation structures on the first call. I prefer percentage of gross revenues. There are times when you can't do it. Sometimes there's legal impositions in an industry where they literally cannot pay you a percentage of revenues. And then you have to come up with a structure where they're paying you by the lead. They're paying you by the number of times the phone rings. They're paying you by piece mailed. I've done infomercials in a couple of industries where there was no way I was going to get paid on gross revenues, and so then I got use fees. So every time they air the show, they got to pay $75, that kind of thing.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, Lori, I think we can squeeze one more, maybe.
Please, Tony.
Everyone's going. Tony, go ahead.
Hey, Dan, just based on what you just said, when you're calculating in your mind how long it's going to take you to finish a project in terms of the number of days, is your day like an 8-hour, 10-hour day, or is that irrelevant?
It's relevant to you. I mean, to me, yeah, I'm thinking in terms of an 8-hour day. So yeah. If I lock myself in a room for 8-hour days without interruption and did nothing but work on this project, how long will it take to finish it?
Okay.
Can we do one more, please?
Oh, yeah, Lori, this is Kathy.
Hey, Kathy.
Hi. Yeah, you mentioned you could take a piece like for jewelers and Tupelo and extrapolate. How do you do that on the web? Because on the web, everyone could see everybody else's work. Can you make packages of copyright for websites?
Sure. However, you're probably not going to. Well, the way to geographically license that, it's more complicated than an answer I can give you in a minute. Fundamentally, it means you have to control the sites themselves. And so, for example, in a campaign I just recently did, actually it's tied to the one I described in the financial advisor category, there's a national site with a name. This isn't it, but let's say for the sake of conversation, it's the National Association of Certified Small Business Financial Advisors. There's a national site. And then within that are state sites and then each participating individual site. So a user is going to go down the tree to find them, and I'm controlling the whole site. So you've got licensed copy on a site that you're renting from me. And if you stop paying the monthly rent, by the way, you get disconnected, and I resell it to somebody else in your area. So that's the way you play geography on the net. There's also industry-by-industry licensing, where you might be able to take the same copy you did, let's in healthcare, you might be able to take the same thing you did for a dentist, tweak it slightly and use it for an optometrist, and tweak it slightly and use it for a cosmetic surgeon, and you may be able to license it industry by industry by industry. I'm sorry, that's real quick, but I hope it's helpful.
Excellent, thank you.
Okay.
I just had a real quick, how do you change your contract? This is Michelle.
Michelle.
If you're going to resell like an ad campaign, How do you deal with the client? Like the client says, well, you're reselling that for $400, and I think
it's none of his business. You retain rights to the work product outside of his market area, or his niche, or his industry. However it is, you're going to carve it up.
Okay, but what if he complains? Well, like that, I gave it. I charge him $1,000 to create it personally, and I'm reselling it at $400. What if he complains about that?
Read your contract, sir.
Okay.
I retain the rights to the work product.
Okay. All right, well, we're out of time. Dan, thank you very much for doing this. I think you've done a great service to those copywriters.
Yeah.
I'll be sending everybody a summary of the call. The audio will be up tomorrow, and the transcript will be ready within a week. And do stop by red-hot-copy.com/dan.htm to see what is up there. And thanks, everyone. Have a fantastic night.
Thanks a lot, gang. Thanks, Lori. Good night.
Thank you, Dan. Bye.
Thank you.